this morning, I want to talk, of course, about Martin Luther King. I want us to remember some of the things he talked about, things that might be helpful to us now. I want us to remember him as someone who still has relevance to us today. I'm worried, you see. I'm worried that in an era where so many of Dr. King's thoughts and teachings are just as challenging and important as they were 40 years ago, that we have consigned him to the past, lionized him as a hero, and forgotten what he was really about. He was assassinated before I was even born. Growing up, I knew his name. I heard his I Have a Dream speech, usually once a year, about this time. And I knew, of course, that he had to do with the African-American civil rights movement of the 1960s. No history class I ever took in school included any history later than World War II. And so I didn't especially know much about Martin Luther King when I became a Unitarian Universalist. But it was clear that the Martin Luther King holiday was a very big deal at the Unitarian Universalist church I was attending, and many congregants had memories of marching with Dr. King. I felt the generational difference between us. Having marched with Dr. King was clearly meant to be an emblem of one's commitment to social justice work. I felt frustrated that we had to look back 40 years to find meaningful social justice work to talk about. To me, Martin Luther King began to stand as a symbol of a generational divide in a discussion about racism. One generation remembering with yearning his vision and leadership, the next generation tired, perhaps, of hearing stories from decades ago. The struggle to overcome racism has changed, and boycotts and marches no longer feel like effective tools of resistance. So I want to stop and say that I imagine there are people in the room already upset by some of what I've just said. So I want to invite us to take a breath together. I am not telling you that I am right or that your memories of Dr. King are irrelevant. I am telling you that for some of us, there is a generational difference in what people know and understand about Martin Luther. My first semester at Starr King School for the Ministry, I took a class on nonviolent social transformation. And in that class, we read the words of Cesar Chavez, Dorothy Day, Mahatma Gandhi, and of course, Martin Luther King. For the first time, I read his words, not just a few well-known sermons, but his essays, books, and autobiographical reflections. I was transformed. My understanding of ministry was transformed. My understanding of the world was transformed. Some of you here have known Dr. King for 40 or 50 years. I just met him 2 years ago. His loss is very fresh to me, and I mourn him. I cannot read or hear the closing words of his final sermon without crying. In the course of a month or so of reading, I had discovered a dear, dear friend and lost him all at once. I thought a lot about whether or not friend was the right word to describe him. If Dr. King is my friend, he is the kind of friend who tells you when you are way off course, when your actions are misguided, your excuses paltry, your courage lacking, your commitment weak. He is a truth teller, someone who tells it like it is, even when the truth feels unbearable and the path forward extremely uncertain. In his writings, he is plain speaking in his disappointments with white people, with religious white people in particular, people who should have been allies in the civil rights movement, but were instead silent and complacent. This honesty, though, this extraordinary honesty, is why we still need him, why we still have much to learn from him. Because when Martin Luther King tells us that it is possible to love our enemies, we must believe him. He is not the sort of friend who would fudge the truth about something like that. And he knows that kind of love is not easy. When Martin Luther King talks about loving enemies, he is talking about black people loving white people who advocated for segregation, white people who participated in mob violence against black people. He is talking about loving people who, when the time came, failed to stand up for justice. He knew that this kind of love does not come easy. He never did ask us to do anything that was easy. He writes, "When you come to love on this level, you begin to love others not because they are likable, not because they do things that attract us, but because God loves them. And here we love the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that person does." Unquote. This idea of love for all humanity was not new. In fact, it was ancient, stretching back to the Greeks. The Greek language has three different words for love: eros, a romantic and sensual love; philia, a reciprocal love between personal friends; and agape, this third love, the understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all humanity. This is the love we can feel even for those who oppose us, those who would seek to defeat us. Ancient ideas, but new to me, my first semester in seminary. I was astounded by the idea that I should and could feel love for people I can't stand. Those politicians whose opinions differ from mine, those classmates whose annoying behavior is off-putting, that landlord whose unleashed dog chased my cat up the stairs and into my apartment. Could I love them? It did not take me long to recognize that the idea of agape love is embedded in our Unitarian Universalist principle to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I had always understood this principle to be, at its heart, about social justice. The inherent worth and dignity of the disenfranchised, the oppressed, the marginalized. It had not occurred to me before this that I need also be concerned with the inherent worth and dignity of the privileged, the arrogant, the intrusive, or the annoying. The inherent worth and dignity of those who would oppose that which I believe in, who would, if given the chance, destroy the ideals I hold most dear. Love for all humanity. Dr. King tells us it's an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. Not easy. Just a week ago, gun violence in Tucson, Arizona resulted in the death of 6 people, with injuries to 13 more. There has not yet been a trial, but the prevailing wisdom is that there was one man with a gun, and that the overriding reason for the violence is his untreated mental illness. The fact that the shooting took place in Arizona is understood by many of us to be a symptom of the hate speech and discrimination directed at people of color in that state. For many of us, politics in Arizona, this past year especially, have typified the very worst aspects of our culture. Anti-immigrant backlash, fear-mongering, and reactionary politics have become the norm. Dialogue between those of differing opinions has become almost non-existent. I lament this state of affairs, but I have to admit, I don't think most of us really know how to talk with people who disagree with us. It's easier not to talk at all. Politics, we're told, is too upsetting for conversation. I'm not going to change my mind, you're not going to change your mind, so let's stay away from difficult conversations. Martin Luther King did not stay away from difficult conversations. In his letter from Birmingham City Jail, he writes of his disappointment with white moderates. Moderates, not conservatives. I guess I should have realized that few members of a race that has oppressed another race can understand or appreciate the deep groans and passionate yearnings of those that have been oppressed, and still fewer have the vision to see that injustice must be rooted out by strong, persistent, and determined action. Unquote. He did not mince words. He was not shy, and he was not particularly concerned with making people happy by telling them something they want to hear. But somehow he managed to hold a mirror up to white culture, naming the injustice he saw, describing the resistance to change, and in doing so, he changed people's minds. His secret, as far as I can tell, besides his eloquence and his determination, his secret to changing the world, which he did, was that he loved the people he was trying to change. He loved his enemies, and they could hear what he was saying. Thank you. not under the impression that Dr. King worked to end segregation with persuasive words and love in his heart alone. Of course not. We hear so often that Dr. King was all about nonviolence. I worry we are forgetting he was about nonviolent resistance. Resistance. Injustice must be rooted out by strong, persistent, and determined action. The civil rights movement is remembered in part for its effective boycotts, protests, and marches. These actions were never undertaken lightly. Dr. King writes about his soul searching prior to the Montgomery bus boycott. He wondered, were we following an ethical course of action? Is the boycott method basically unchristian? Isn't it a negative approach to the solution of a problem? Even if lasting practical results come from such a boycott, would immoral means justify moral ends? This questioning, this reflection, this introspection lent power to these acts of resistance. I think part of my generation's fatigue with protests and marches comes from a sense that nowadays they are not always as well thought out as they could be. As we learned from Dr. King, effective political action rarely takes place without forethought, planning, strategy, and ongoing support. In Montgomery, weekly meetings at black churches helped boycotters keep the faith. Dr. King describes, night after night, the group was admonished to love rather than hate, and urged to be prepared to suffer violence if necessary, but never to inflict it. The Montgomery bus boycott had separate committees for transportation, finance, program, strategy, and registration and voting. The boycott lasted over a year and resulted in desegregation of the public transit system. It remains a model of powerful social justice action and nonviolent resistance. If you follow Arizona politics at all, then you've probably heard of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He promotes himself as America's toughest sheriff and has become well known for his outspoken stance against illegal immigration. He is currently the subject of investigations by the FBI, the United States Department of Justice, and the federal grand jury for civil rights violations and abuses of power. He's also the defendant in a federal class action suit for racial profiling. He is one of the most easily identifiable bad guys in the volatile political arena of Arizona. This past summer, a new immigration law went into effect in Arizona, a law that demonizes undocumented workers and all people of color. Unitarian Universalists from around the country traveled to Arizona in late July to participate in organized nonviolent protest. Protesters were trained in nonviolent resistance techniques with the expectation of being arrested for civil disobedience. 26 Unitarian Universalists were arrested, including our association president, Reverend Peter Morales. Also arrested was a woman named Mar Cardenas. a ministry team coordinator from one of our San Diego churches. When Sheriff Joe Arpaio came to the jail to look at the people who'd been arrested that day protesting, Mark Cardenas told him, "I love you." And she made the shape of a heart with her hands. Dr. King writes, "Hate begets hate. Violence begets violence. Toughness begets a greater toughness. We must meet the forces of hate with the power of love. We must meet physical force with soul force." In meeting Joe Arpaio, Mar Cardenas met the force of hate with the power of love. In our reading for today, Dr. King tells us, "This may well be humanity's last chance to choose between chaos and community." 44 years ago, he wrote of the fierce urgency of now. There is such a thing as being too late. I agree with him. Now is always the time. We must choose community over chaos. We must not wait. We must choose love. I don't claim to know what that looks like for you. In Dr. King's memory, I am not here to provide easy answers. I only know that we all have times in our lives when it is tempting to hate. It is tempting because hate is easy. Easy to demonize those who disagree with us. Easy to belittle others behind their backs. Easy to remain silent rather than to engage. What I am calling on you to do, the next time you find yourself confronting the forces of hate, whoever or whatever that is in your life, to look your enemy in the eyes and say, in your heart, if not out loud, "I love you." Tomorrow is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the United States, in celebration of what would have been his 82nd birthday. In remembrance of Dr. King, the 9th annual Peace March in Hayward is tomorrow, beginning at 9:30 a.m. at City Hall. This congregation is one of the founding organizers of this event. What makes this event special and important in my eyes, and many of those who regularly participate, is that there are no speeches from local politicians, or religious leaders, or anyone. Two youth choirs will sing, one from Congregation Shear Me and one from First United Methodist Church. And then participants will take turns reading the words of Martin Luther King. The focus of the event is remembering him, his words, the challenge and the inspiration that he embodied. I hope you will join us there. May we continue to remember him. May we continue to learn from him. May it be so. Blessed be.